Hello. The closer you get to a black hole in space, the more that distant events seem to accelerate, happening faster and faster until they all appear to be taking place at the same time, collapsing on top of one another in a violation of causality. None of this matters to you, though, because you're being torn to pieces by powerful forces you don't really understand, could never control, and should probably have left well alone. Hello, and welcome to another edition of Romaniacs, a podcast about Brexit. I'm Andrew Harrison, and it is squeaky Brexit time. Yeah, you join us towards the end of Theresa May's crucial 48 hours, and God knows what things will be like by the time you hear this. We record at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, so if the wheels come off at the EU summit tonight, we may well be meeting in a car park for an emergency podcast before long. Whatever. As events in the Theresa May versus the ERG versus Brussels versus the DUP infinity war spiral to some sort of a climax, possibly, we've got a no-guests week for the first time in ages. This means Ian Dunn can swear as much as he likes without offending the guests. Gathering to discuss this over a proper British pizza like the ERG, that's with cockles, beef Wellington and extra black pudding, are Nina Schick, political commentator, regular face on Bloomberg, Sky, BBC and CNBC, an expert on Russian disinformation and Brexit, which are not in any way related. Hello, Nina. How are you?
Hi, Andrew.
You've been on holiday. Were you tempted to not come back?
Well, I was in California. So then I thought about politics in the US and, you know, kind of decided to come back after all.
Yes, it's very much frying pan fire type scenario.
Nowhere to go, nowhere to stay.
Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. From watching this stuff from the distance, does it lend any kind of clarity? Because we're basically in the tumble dryer that is Brexit and you're watching it from California.
When you're abroad, you kind of realise that this national psychodrama, hysteria, as soon as you leave the country, it's taken down a few notches. I think the rest of the world is still baffled and doesn't really care much. So it's always quite funny when you read headlines when you're abroad about how the EU needs to do more, or this is the time when the EU is going to fold, from British politicians. You're like, God, they really are so not in line with the mood music or the reality.
Yeah. With your Russian disinformation hat on, did you notice the story last week about the woman who was supposedly splashing bleach into the groins of men who were manspreading on the Russian metro, turned out to have been completely made up by, in the now, a Kremlin?
Absolutely. I think you cannot take away the Russian kind of disinformation war or undermining of Western liberal democracies from Brexit, neither from the election of Donald Trump. It's quite clear what they're trying to do. They're trying to undermine the process of democracy. And I think it's pretty well documented right now that there was Russian involvement in the referendum campaign, just as there was Russian involvement in the election of Donald Trump, just as there was Russian involvement across many European elections, and we'll continue to see that. We'll continue to see it amping up. And what they seek to do is divide the electorate, so push kind of those issues which people are going to be most divided on, so whether that's issues of femininity, whether that's issues of identity politics, and in the case of Britain, Brexit.
Yes, we'll be returning to this a little bit later, actually. Also here with us is Naomi Smith, Chief Operating Officer at Best for Britain, currently in the thick of finalising Saturday's People's Vote March. Hello, Naomi. Big week for you.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good.
Are your nerves?
Nerves are fine. I think it's going to be really big. Mm-hmm. If we sort of take the numbers that we've got signed up today versus the numbers we had signed up in June, and then the numbers that we know actually turned out in June, the extrapolation is looking really, really good for Saturday. So the weather's looking to be pretty good because, you know, we are in late October now. So that was always going to be a bit of a risk. But it looks like it's going to be good, not turning people away. So don't hesitate about going. Just go. If you're listening, go. Buses are being laid on from literally every town in the country. There really is no excuse. And I guess what I really love listeners to do is to try and bring a person with them that would never normally do this kind of thing. Mm. Just double the numbers. Just bring one more person and we're absolutely there.
I noticed this week that Danielle Hannan, the Lex Luthor of Leave, has now come out for a people's vote. What happened there? How can this be? And do we want him?
Well, he said in a tweet, "I have so far backed the negotiating position on the EU, but staying in the customs union would be the worst of all worlds. Any other outcome, no deal, Canada, Norway, Switzerland, even a second referendum would be preferable."
So we'll take that as a yes. We'll take that as signed off.
He is very welcome to come on the march for a people's vote on Saturday. I'm sure we would have him. I'm not sure that we would give him a platform, though. This is the man who said that Switzerland is successful, partly because, even though it's landlocked, it benefits from not being in the common fisheries policy. So I don't think we're taking too much advice from them. But it's very welcome to march.
Yes, putting it, Switzerland is his preferred model, isn't it? Actually, if he puts people's vote next to Switzerland, that is pretty much the highest recommendation that he can give it.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Well, you heard him there. Also with us is Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, and a man who, after the events of this week, consists of 70% Bisodol, 20% grey market antidepressants, and 10% nicotine. Hello, Ian. Welcome back to the show. How are your nerves this week? It's all getting a bit real, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, with a lot of this, ultimately, I suspect it might be better for us if the deal was to come back sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Or at least that would maximise the chances of MPs voting against it. So even though there's always this bit of sort of fear of seeing it really happening, it might in the long term actually be better if it comes, i.e. this side of Christmas.
Right, this side of Christmas. Because we were promised October, November, weren't we?
Yeah, I suspect that she would... I don't know if she would go to this length, but I suspect that she would quite like, for instance, it to be hitting the Commons in January, when the markets had taken fright, when there was a decline in sterling, and you can go... look at this shit over here. Is this shit what you want? Because if not, here's my deal on the table, and that would maximise her chances. That's one of the theories that is out there. I don't necessarily sign up to it, but it's not incredible to think that might be the case.
That's kind of also what we saw in a leaked report by Germany's Süddeutsche Zeitung a few days ago, where they kind of leaked the EU's internal negotiating timeline. And according to that, the deal would be put to Parliament, just as Ian said, in January, February.
And who knows what listeners are going to think about how out of date we are, because there was a tweet just before we came in the studio that EU and Britain are closer to a Brexit deal than might have been apparent from today's theatre. You know, the rumour mill is starting again that a deal could be imminent. And for campaigners amongst us, what we thought we might have 4 weeks to deliver on could become 2 weeks at a moment's notice.
I think it is increasingly likely that there'll be a deal. Every time she starts talking, like when she started talking yesterday, it suddenly becomes a bigger problem. On Monday, when Theresa May went to the Commons, you suddenly think, oh, you're making it harder now. And making a statement to the Commons at all was a frankly insane thing for her to have done. But when they're not talking, you constantly look at the fundamental issues there and you think a deal is doable if these really are the objections that you have. Whether it is deliverable back in London is another matter entirely, but it does I would be surprised if they don't come to some kind of arrangement.
Yeah, and just to corroborate on that, just been in Brussels, and certainly the mood there is that on the technical level, the technical part of the negotiations, they're done. So it's more a question of political agreement by Theresa May. So I don't think essentially because the UK has kind of capitulated entirely to the EU's position. So it's more a question of how, as we estimated might, you know, be the case, but it's a question of how is Theresa May going to sell this domestically?
Make it look not like a clown down. Right. Well, later on in the show, as well as our latest week from hell, we're going to be talking about the inexplicably slow police action on alleged cheating from the Leave campaign during the referendum. We're going to be wargaming a people's vote campaign if Saturday's march or a vote in the Commons tips events towards a people's vote. It won't be the end of the story, it'll be the beginning. How should we fight the campaign? Where should we concentrate our efforts? And what's most likely to tip the balance in favour of remaining in the EU? And we'll be looking at the latest in the no-deal Brexit notices and why losing your Netflix library when you're abroad will be the least of your worries. All that after a couple of reminders from Nina.
Remainiacs will, of course, be at the March for a People's Vote on Saturday, 20th of October. If you want to come and march, a small representative group of the Remainiacs Central Committee will be gathering opposite the Dorchester on Park Lane. Membership of the Metropolitan League has its perks. Come and say hello, bring your banners, and wear your Remainiacs t-shirts. And you can march under the official Remainiacs banner with the winning slogan, which is Fromage, not Farage. Meanwhile, remember, you can get every episode of Remainiacs a day early when you sign up to support us on the crowdfunding site Patreon. Support our valuable work with a small contribution, and we'll send you every episode as soon as it trundles off our high-tech robot-assisted podcast assembly line. We very much appreciate your support, and of course, you'll get stylish merchandise like mugs and t-shirts and early bird access to tickets to our live shows and a weekly column written by one of our panel as well. Search Patreon Remainiacs for more information or just go to the Remainiacs Facebook page. And we will see you at the People's Vote March on Saturday.
Thanks, Nina. Now, let's try to read the scattered tea leaves of the week's Brexit news. Firstly, it's crunch time again for Brexit. As Theresa May tried to rally support around what's left of Chequers, tensions ran unexpectedly high at the weekend when it seemed suddenly possible that the government and the EU really were going to do a deal. Dominic Raab, the Father Dougal of DexEU, unexpectedly flew to meet Michel Barnier in Brussels on Sunday night amid reports that the deal was all but done, and then, in a single bound, it wasn't. And they would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for that meddling Irish backstop. Meanwhile, the Brexit extremists are conspiring over pizza. The DUP says it will paralyse Maisie Gentry if she makes Northern Ireland in any way distinct from the rest of the UK. And senior EU sources are saying that the chances of Wednesday summit making any difference at all are significantly diminished. Ian, firstly, what the hell happened at the weekend?
We're not sure, really. I mean, like, there's lots of different theories. I mean, one of them is that it's all pure theatre and just done, you know, in order to create the kind of timeline that we were discussing now about later. And I don't think that is 100% the case, but also it's possible for there to be genuine fallings out and misunderstandings, which I think there were, but also for both sides to think it doesn't ultimately do any harm if this happens anyway, because we still have, the, according to our internal timetable, is more luxurious than the external one as we make it out to be. It's possible that Theresa May, that Ollie Robbins thought he was authorised to make suggestions that Theresa May had either not understood when she gave to him or that he had got the wrong end of the stick on. Or it's possible that they really have fundamentally misunderstood what the backstop is. Because when they started, Downing Street tried to resell the backstop on sort of Sunday night, Monday, as, well, look, the EU have added an extra backstop, which applies to Ireland, only Ireland, rather than the whole of the UK. Now, I don't believe that they have misunderstood it that badly, because that is just what the backstop is. I mean, what they're calling the actual backstop is their future relationship proposal, which would mean that the backstop was unnecessary. I know that it's impossible to talk about this without just feeling like you're getting lost in this Kafkaesque nightmare world of completely meaningless jargon. But this stuff does have sort of real meaning to it, to a certain extent. I should caveat that. Not empirically in the real world or according to the rules of logic, but it does have PR meaning to it.
Right.
And that's essentially the language
so
that you need
like
to be
rules
in, comprehending.
It's like the rules of Dungeons and Dragons. They exist within the world and the reality of the game, the conceit of the game. Yeah. So if you throw a hexagonal dice and it lands on backstop, it's effectively...
It's like the shittest game of Dungeons and Dragons of all time. And that is a pretty low bar.
It's all just dungeons, just no dragons. Yeah. Sorry, and I interrupted you there with trying to...
No, but that's pretty much... So we don't know which of those outcomes it was. I think we have a clearer idea now of where we are, and the suggestions that are coming out at the moment, which seem to be coming from Barnier, I think are pretty... start to suggest the outlines of how something might be done. And that's mostly about what if we try to deal with the backstop by adding a bit more time to the transitional period? And what if we tried to put some kind of legal linkage between the withdrawal agreement, which is the divorce bit, and the future relationship part? And that covers the two areas of concern, which is time. What if there's a gap between the end of the transition and the implementation of a new deal, which there fucking
there will be
of many years. And the other part is, how do you control for whoever takes over from May, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn or Jacob Rees-Mogg or whoever the hell, deciding they want to have a completely different future relationship that would mean that the backstop needs to be triggered. So that idea of consistency of the British desire for what the future relationship is and taking care of the time problem would potentially be covered by the kind of proposals that are coming out right now. Whether they are palatable in Westminster is another matter entirely.
Naomi mentioned earlier that the DUP were unsurprisingly intransigent here. They let it be known that there will be guerrilla war against the backstop, whatever kind of backstop it may be, and that the Irish border plan could destroy power sharing for good. So what do we need to know about this?
Well, I mean, you know, it's. I think I've said it on this podcast before that the DUP want alignment with the UK. They want to leave the EU and have no difference between how Northern Ireland is treated and the rest of the UK, because they love alignment, except definitely not on gay marriage, on abortion rights, on employment rights, you know. So, yes, they are, you know, this minority party with a minority viewpoint that have overplayed their hand and are really effectively being allowed to dictate the terms of the Brexit deal at the moment. And you know, power sharing, I mean, look, come on, how long has Stormont been suspended for now? 2 years already, 5 years before that. You know, they're not they're wanting their cake and eat it, but, you know, they have always been clear on this. So when we talk about, you know, whether she can sell that deal in Westminster, it's whether she can sell it in Belfast.
You almost imagine it's a bad idea to think you could treat a narrow group of unrepresentative extremists as if they run the country. I can't think of any contiguous examples of this.
No,
we mentioned this a moment ago. The idea that Sunday night and Rob's exciting journey was theatre. Do you think it was primarily theatre to raise the stakes and make it more likely that a deal is signed?
I think it's a bit of both. So I think it's quite plausible that, you know, some Brexiteers are too stupid to realize what they kind of already signed up to in December and the truth of what the backstop actually means is hitting them. And I think there, of course, is a bit of optics involved in making sure that Theresa May can pass this domestically. I was talking to some friends about, you know, what does this actually mean? Where is it taking the UK in the future? And kind of my view on this is that basically, the UK will sign up to some kind of deal and we can put the wording around the backstop in kind of like a Russian stacking dolls type scenario where it becomes ever more complex and not clear what it means, and people kind of take what they want from it. But essentially, the UK will kind of end up in a customs union ad infinitum. The next part, you know, the next question about like when is the next crunch is obviously going to be around 2020, 2021, when the transition ends. Guess what? The UK is going to be facing a cliff edge. Yet again, I think people sometimes forget that this part of the negotiation is just the withdrawal agreement, which just we haven't even started talking about future relations. And given that the withdrawal agreement has taken us 2 years of repeating the same arguments again and again, and, you know, 2 years after we've left, it's going to be the same thing. And the EU still has something on its side. It has the power of 27 versus one, and it's got time pressure. So I think this process where we see the UK basically buckling and then, like Syriza in 2015 in the Eurozone crisis, basically taking the EU's position, I think, is going to continue. So then you really ask yourself the question, if the UK is going to remain in a customs union ad infinitum, what was the point?
Yeah.
What was the point of this exercise?
And I have always argued that soft Brexit will probably just delay a harder Brexit because it won't appease all of the people who wanted Brexit in the first place.
Exactly. Everyone's going to be unhappy.
Well, they can be like me then, unhappy all the time. One X factor that was kind of thrown into the pond, the rippling pond this week, was the sudden impending fall of John Bercow. Initially, when you're kind of naive like me, you look at that and you go, well, what's that got to do with Brexit? But as Naomi pointed out, it's actually got quite a lot to do with Brexit.
Yeah, the role of the Speaker can rule motions being in and out of order. They have a huge amount of power over parliamentary process. And we are in a period where parliamentary process and tinkering with it and the dynamics of it are exactly what everyone involved in this campaign is trying to do, whether they are trying to stop Brexit or trying to make sure Brexit happens. People on all sides are politicking and using every weird bit of parliamentary procedure to get things to go in their way. There is a pretty received wisdom that there will be a very, very strong push for Bercow to be replaced by a very strong Leaver, although I know that Harriet Harman and other people have sort of thrown their hat into the ring. But with every one of those, then you've got one less vote on your side in a meaningful vote, or, you know, in the various votes that we know that are going to happen over the next few weeks with all of this. So it's a case of being careful what you wish for. You know, I want Harriet Harman's vote. I need it. I need to make sure that Labour are voting down the government deal. But then again, I don't want a Speaker who is likely to rule motions out of order against our favour.
This is one of the sort of symptoms of a political system that's in bad shape, is that the idea that there can be no neutrals and there can be no sets of clean hands. Everybody must have an angle.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's the important point is really his view on Brexit. I think the important point is the extent of his independence, autonomy and confidence when it comes to interpreting the things that come to the House. Now, he has shown over a long time that he's actually willing to stand up to the government pretty hard. In 2013, he put down a third amendment to the Queen's speech in favour of, basically, in favour of the Brexiters at the time, saying, why isn't there any referendum bill here when you said that there would be? Now, that was constitutionally unprecedented, but he did it. Now, the expectation then is that if we get to the end of this, everything's been voted down, and just imagine that in sort of January, February, the government is trying to push through no deal. According to the law now, on January 27th, they make a neutral motion to the Commons going, there is going to be no deal. What that motion will really say is, a debate has been held on this. Now, constitutionally, that should be unamendable. However, to buy off Dominic Grieve and others, the government explicitly said it's the Speaker who makes the decision. That was already constitutionally true but it opened the door for a very confident speaker, and there'd have to be a very confident speaker, ideally a speaker who was about to step down anyway, as he is going to in the summer, to go, well, the wording of this motion is less important than the intention of this motion, and therefore I think that it is amendable. And if it is amendable, you could have MPs saying to the government, you must go back to the drawing board. You must at least involve, you know, involve us in this other aspect. You must have a second referendum. You must hold even a general election. That opens up doors to how things could start operating. I don't think, it's hard to imagine anyone else in that position, especially someone starting out their time as speaker, taking that call. I do believe that John Bercow might take that call. Now, consider from just the amount of vitriol and hatred that would be directed at you. You need a very specific person at a very specific time in their career. He's that guy. And part of the reason that this week in the Commons, you saw Tory backbenchers standing up, acting like they gave a flying fuck about bullying, was specifically because they saw that eventuality coming down the rails, potentially being a problem for them. And that's why they were trying to remove him.
And that is not to say to any listeners that we don't think that bullying needs to be sorted out in the House of Commons, that it is a dreadful place to work at the moment, that we need to do much more safeguarding. So I just want to be really clear that we are not saying that all of that
that's the context.
It's as Jess Phillips said, which is ultimately, it doesn't mean that the thing doesn't matter, but you guys over there do not
stop
give a shit about this thing.
Exactly.
And if you really gave a fuck about it, you wouldn't be playing politics with it in the first place.
Jess Phillips, the Speaker.
Moving on quickly, are the police stalling their investigation into alleged cheating by the Leave campaign because of, quote, political sensitivities? That's what the investigative website Open Democracy alleged this week. Pushed on why there had been no progress on the investigation, a Scotland Yard spokesman admitted there were issues of political sensitivities that had to be taken into account. Conservative MP Damian Collins, chair of the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee, demanded to know why the Met had failed to launch a formal investigation. They weren't so worried about political sensitivities when they kicked down Damian Green's door, he said, referring to the 2008 Home Office leaks investigation. And meanwhile, connecting with something we mentioned earlier, the Met said it will not investigate Russian meddling in the referendum because international bodies and states cannot commit criminal offences under electoral legislation. Interesting thought there. Naomi, one hesitates to say the sky is falling, but if the police are too scared to investigate alleged crimes because of political sensitivities, do we really have a properly working system of law?
No. And it's just this absolute terrible state of our democracy. I should just say massive hats off to Adam Ramsey at Open Democracy, who's been plugging away at this story for months, if not years, daring to expose what other people couldn't or wouldn't or whatever. And we absolutely should get him on the show, actually. And remember, he exposed the DUP. This is a bit of a Northern Irish themed podcast today, but he exposed the DUP shadowy, I think it was £435,000 in dark money that was mostly spent during the referendum by the Leave campaign on a massive advert in the Metro, and the Metro isn't even distributed in Northern Ireland, it's only on the mainland. We've also now had 77 MPs write to the head of the National Crime Agency and the Met Police asking them about this pressure of political sensitivity and the pressure that they're under. So I guess we have to sort of wait and see what comes out of that. But, you know, it is very disappointing. What, has it been 5 months since it was referred? And the political sensitivity, just to add, you know, we do know that, you know, one of the people who's been referred to the police for investigation works in Number 10. You know, this does go right to the door of the Prime Minister herself.
Ian, you're making disagreeing noises there.
I think all of that's true, and it's dispiriting, and they're making the wrong judgment. But, you know, we just have to keep the we do still have a functioning system of law in this country, which will, you know, survive the police's ineptitude one way or another. I mean, I think it's useful, that comparison that he made with the way they behaved over Damian Green, which is just completely overhanded policing, which didn't have any kind of constitutional respect or any just kind of sensibleness about the way in which they conducted themselves, about the process. And sometimes they get it wrong the other way. I don't think it's a conspiracy. It's just, it's a bad judgment. What I found a bit concerning was that second part where he said, according to sort of electoral law, we can't do anything against foreign actors. And you think, well, the thing is that foreign actors would be operating through domestic bodies, you know, whether it was someone connected with the Leave campaign or otherwise. So you don't go, we're going to try and put Putin in the dock. Mm. What you do is you say, well, what are the connections that they would have made through deals, through financial deals or anything else with domestic individuals or organizations? Right. And those have been discussed. So there is no reason for them not to be pursuing that. And it's troubling that they used a constitutional, well, sort of a legal excuse, which doesn't really seem to pertain and which no one which understood the stuff would thought did pertain.
And the reality is that debate has to evolve as realities are changing. So not only has it been proven that there was Russian interference in the Brexit referendum campaign through domestic bodies, but they're also able to intervene in information spaces that did not exist, you know, before. In specific, I'm talking about social media. You know, I'm working with the former NATO Secretary General, and we've looked at the disinformation around the Brexit referendum campaign. And politically, there has been a kind of kickback, like, we don't want to know. We don't want to open that can of worms. It's very difficult to quantify, you know, whether it swung the referendum or not. But that doesn't change the reality that it happened and will continue to happen, not only in issues like the Brexit referendum campaign, and not only by actors like Russia. I mean, Iran, China, the rest of the kind of autocratic world is looking. And if you consider, I mean, I'm working right now on the kind of technology developments that are absolutely going to upend this. So we're talking about fake news and people existing in their cognitive dissonance chambers. Just down the line, you know, AI power technology and something called deepfake is going to be able to computer generate fake audio and video to a degree that is undiscernible from the real thing. So you can imagine if people live in these cognitive dissonance chambers and they're plugged into social media, your reality, which could be a fake reality, becomes what you believe. So absolutely the law has to evolve to be to understand the fact that foreign actors will intervene in highly politicized and polarizing political events like this in our democracies.
I think it's that phrase, political sensibilities, sensitivities that made people's alarm bells go, because the idea that should be introduced into the consideration at all is kind of worrying, isn't it? I mean, we don't look at political sensitivities in any other context.
Let's be realistic, okay? And this is not a good thing, but police forces listen to what politicians say. If you get a prime minister that comes in and goes, the main thing about my administration is going to be I'm going to do a crackdown on drugs, you will find that police chiefs say to their guys, guys, go out there and get me some drug busts and prioritise drugs over burglary or whatever. Yeah. And so that has always been the case, that there is a bendy relationship there. It isn't good, but it isn't new.
And in the case of the Met, the co-head of the Met is Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London. He is the co-head of the Met Police. He is obviously an elected politician. And so I'll be very interested to see if he wades into this debate or not, given that it's the Met that are being asked to look at this.
Well, there is a real failure here, which is that, okay, so you've got it on policing. We've got it, I think, at a regulator level. When you look at the way that the Electoral Commission has behaved, I think from anyone's perspective over the last few months, over the last couple of years, whether it's on the Remain campaign or the Leave campaign, you just think, you have not been getting this done very well, guys. They've had to be pushed into stuff. Once they've been pushed into it, they don't seem to have quite gotten it right. So there's an argument, I think, for root and branch sort of change to the way the Electoral Commission operates. You're getting it politically, where I feel like Remainers have been pretty sanguine and pretty controlled about saying, look, clearly there was interference. We're not in a position to say that that's what won the campaign, but there are reasons to be alarmed. Mm. And we haven't seen that reflected in the Brexit side of going, look, we see that this happened to be in our favour in this case, or it seems to be that way. Nevertheless, next time it might not be, and we need to start fixing up against any kind of foreign intrusion. There's a real failure across the board, of which policing is a part.
Do you think go ahead.
Just to add another point, the point of this interference is also procedural. So it's to undermine faith in democracy. So when we looked at the US election in 2016, we saw the Russian kind of interference pushing messages both in favor of Trump, but also in favor of Sanders. So it's the
massive
disruption. Yeah. The whole point of it is to cause chaos and disruption. Yeah. Yeah. And the same thing has happened in the United Kingdom around Brexit, but also you see interference pushing pro-Corbyn messages, pro-Remain messages, pro-Brexit messages, because you basically want to divide the electorate. And this has to be acknowledged in the public debate. You cannot... I know it sounds scary, but like this, you cannot begin to regulate an electoral process, nor actually have a sensible conversation about democracy and the kind of divides we see in our country right now without acknowledging that this kind of activity exists.
Well, as I feel like I say after every single story we talk about on this show, this one's going to come back to haunt us. Shall we have 5 minutes to look at the last round of no-deal notices? You know, they may take our
what
lives.
What fun!
Yeah, what fun! They may take our lives, but they'll never take our Netflix. Friday was a good day to bury bad news. What day isn't a good day to bury good news? Because every day is awful these days. The government chose Friday to release the final 76 Brexit planning notices. They were as cheery as expected. Amongst our favourites, Eurostar travel between London, Paris, Amsterdam and Brussels could be disrupted in the event of no deal. And you'll have to sort out your own insurance and ticket terms. The government's not going to be looking out for you. You may have no legal protection on buying products and services from the EU. There will temporarily be no checks on high-risk food or animal feed from the EU after 29th of March if there's no deal. Northern Ireland's electricity supply from the public could be cut off, and you may no longer be able to access your Spotify, Netflix, Apple Music or other music and film libraries on holiday. Nina, how are holidaying families going to survive without being able to tell the kids to shut up and watch Captain Underpants? this is surely going to be the breaking point.
Yeah, it's a grim prospect, isn't it? I mean, Britain is basically just going to be the country of Brexit disruption and royal babies. I mean, can you imagine everybody sitting around King's Cross, you know, with their crying children? I mean, it's these are the type of things that are really going to be felt by regular people. You know, if you can't use Spotify, yes, you can't use Netflix, you can't use your international roaming for free. I mean, that's when the crunch really hits.
But we'll have British Netflix and you'll be able to watch the good old days.
I think we have to have a trial run. We have to have a trial run because, as you've quite rightly said, it will hit them, but they don't believe that it will yet.
Yeah.
And until they feel it, they won't really believe it. And by then it's too fucking late. So I think we have to have like Brexit fortnight where everyone gets to see what it's actually going to be
before
like.
Before you buy. Exactly. That would have been a really great idea. Yeah. That would be like, we're going to do Brexit fortnight and see what you think. You're going to have nothing on telly but the black and white minstrels and see what you think.
There was a paper as well for the finally on third-party trade deals, which I just want to pop the bubble of fun that was going around the table and just bring it back to some kind of terrible hellhole of tedium. So they've been saying for ages this wasn't going to be a problem. Liam Fox assured us he'd be able to flip these over whenever he chose to pay any of the mildest attention to it. Finally, the paper came out saying that isn't the case. Now, there's about 40 of these deals with about 70 countries. It covers about 12% of our trade. What that is that's all the trade we do with non-EU countries through EU deals. This is on things like public procurement, on intellectual property, and of course on stuff like tariffs. And what it said was, we could have done what can we possibly fucking do? Because of course, you know, you get no deal, you haven't arranged it with them. Even if there's a deal, this can be a problem, because all we've got right now is the EU saying, we agree with them that we would rather you guys rolled it over. No fucking guarantees whatsoever that they will actually do that.
Yeah.
And in many cases, it's a very disadvantageous position for those countries to be in, to suddenly have to roll over something which has changed and may not even be legal for them to do that, given that the conditions of it have changed from the ones that was presented to parliamentarians in whatever country they're in at the time. This is a massive problem, and if those deals can't be suddenly done in what? February, you know, in 2-3 weeks, you know, that you're doing, then you have to go into WTO terms. And WTO terms, as we said many times before, is you cannot discriminate in your tariffs. So if it goes up on one, it goes up on all of them. If you put it low on one, you put it low on the others. And that's the kind of cack-handed, chaotic horror story that is presented to you when Liam Fox so smugly in front of the Tory party conference is going, oh, it's fine mate, I could do that in my slippers. It's like, well, you have fucking failed, mate. And now the evidence is there, and of course noticed by almost no one.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, let's reiterate that what the international department, the trade department, has been doing for the past 2 years is trying to maintain the existing trade deal. They're just trying to roll it over. So I'm sorry, Liam Fox, but he might have to retire his yacht Brexitania, which was you know, meant to sail the high seas in favor of trading opportunities. There is no way that's happening. And given that I think we're going to end up in a customs union ad infinitum, I don't, you know, that means that it would never happen.
He's increasingly this fascinating psychological object to me, because he stands there. He didn't quit on that day that David Davis and Boris Johnson quit. He stands there every day when the announcements come out, say on customs and tariffs or whatever, or say on maintaining regulatory standards. What they're doing is they're making it completely impossible for him to ever do his job, because you're never going to get a UK trade deal that doesn't involve us lowering our tariffs or our regulatory standards in order to secure penetration of our financial services. That is what they will entail. If they take away all of his leverage, he can't do it. He would fucking fail anyway. But he definitely can't do it if they've taken away all the levers. And he just keeps standing. You just think, why are you still there, mate? Do you not understand that your job has effectively ceased to exist? And yet, he's still there. It's amazing. And actually, the embarrassment that I presume he feels when he's alone in a room almost makes up for the fucking horror story that my life has become as I have to read about this shit every day.
I don't think, like, I think you're overestimating his ability for shame and embarrassment.
No, fair
because
point.
You don't get
fair
to be
point.
There. You don't get to be that yeah. person with any. If you had any capacity for shame, you would have shrunk down like a crisp packet on a radiator on top of on the stove to nothing. You would have vanished into.
Did you have to take that away from me, man? That was like one of the only glimmers of joy I had. Like.
Never mind.
There was also one other pretty egregious thing that they sort of slipped out last week, and again in another week it would have had a much more media exposure than it did, but that was an announcement about EU citizens' rights, which up until that point it had been guaranteed there'll be no change to your rights. If you're here before Brexit Day, your rights are guaranteed as you've got them now, they'll be as they are, and then last week it was made pretty clear that actually that's not going to be the case, and one of the big things that hits them is family members being able to join them. So you know, you might be from you know, France, you've lived here for 30 years, and your mum who still lives in France has a stroke and you actually want to bring her over here to look after her. Not going to happen, not going to be allowed to do that, and so you know, again, a really awful story about how Brexit is actually going to hurt people's lives.
Great fun. Now, I know I said it was a no guest week this week, but actually we have got a surprise guest. Hello.
Hello, my name is Pierce Smith and I'm from Our Future, Our Choice NI in Belfast, so I've got a funny accent. I hope you're okay with
it. It's not a funny accent. Special hint, stop banging the table. I know you're very passionate.
Oh, sorry,
bang, bang, bang. We have to say that to everybody. No, thanks for coming in. So you're part of OFOC.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Now, we have been, and Naomi's doing a little dance here because she grew up in Northern Ireland.
And was educated
in Northern. Now, we have not had anywhere near enough young people and anywhere near enough voices from Northern Ireland on show. Tell me how you came to be involved in OFOC, Our Future, Our Choice.
Okay, gladly. So I'm only 17 years of age. So I was first introduced to OFOC through... So back home, I'm a part of like a lot of political like participation groups for children's rights and children's young people and stuff like that. And with the Northern Ireland's Children's Commissioner, we actually done like a big massive event, Our Brexit 2, Children's Rights, Children's Voices. From that event, made a report, went to Brussels with it, went to London with it. And then I thought that was it over and done with. And then got an email saying, oh, this Lord wants to come meet you and talk about a people's vote. And I had no idea what it was at the time. So I met with Lord Andrew Adonis, who then... had like other people with him, and then just exchanged contact information, briefly talking through the implications of a people's vote. And I was like, perfect, I'm all for it. And then we got in contact with people from Our Future, Our Choice in the UK, and they came and met with us, and then we sort of made our own wee subdivision and we're running it ourselves.
Fantastic.
So. Yeah. Do you feel like, I mean, the Irish backstop comes up a lot on that show, and you know, it remains mystifying even to us, kind of thing.
Same here.
I was about to say, you know, from your point of view, as you see the process unfolding, do you see that the issue of Northern Ireland's border with Southern Ireland is getting enough attention? Because it tends to be treated by people like Rees-Mogg as this a little bit of a detail that's happening somewhere over there, but we needn't worry about it.
Okay, so Rees-Mogg isn't alone when he's talking about that. So we've met with our representatives in Westminster with the DUP, and they say, oh, it's just, these are a lot of ifs, don't worry about it, it'll be fine, just keep kicking the bucket down the road. But the Northern Ireland border, it's in a lot of the headlines or BBC, like it's always, I'm sure you're fed up listening to it, and Dunkirk's are over there, but I don't think there's enough attention being brought to it with regards the emotional side of it, the social side, the implications that sort of way, instead of illegalities, because it's a lot more than legal. There's a lot more political stuff attached to it as well, and the history and stuff like that from the Troubles.
And what about the like cross community element of OFOC Northern Ireland? Like, is
OFOC Northern Ireland?
Is it? I mean, is Brexit an issue that kind of unifies young people across?
Oh,
Catholic Protestant divide.
Yeah, 100%. So, not even just a Catholic and Protestant divide that we have here, but even just all across North Ireland, from Belfast to Fermanagh, we've got people in OFOC NI. So cross community, it does unify a lot of people. Obviously, with regards with anyone, they have their opinions on Brexit, whether they'd like to leave and stuff like that. But with regards to young people, when we're talking to them, it is cross community. People are just like, oh yeah, we voted for Brexit, but don't know what that means, or I didn't vote for it, so I don't really know what it means. All I'm hearing is that it's going to be bad, 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 bad. And we're like, yeah, it is. So,
Is there a sense of, you know, how do people in Northern Ireland feel that Westminster is handling this? Because, I mean, in the run-up to the referendum campaign, the Northern Ireland Secretary, Theresa Villiers, at the time, was saying, it's fine, don't worry about it, technology will sort it out. Is there any sense of anger at Westminster, or is this so polarized that or complicated that people don't really think about it?
I think in Northern Ireland there's always anger at Westminster. But,
right.
With regards how Westminster handled it, it was like, well, no one else is because Stormont's down. So
yeah,
that's frustrating. That's the most frustrating part. So we're not too angry at Westminster, so we're angry at Stormont. And then our only representation are the DUP and Lady Sally Herman, which is an independent. And DUP aren't representing the views of everyone in Northern Ireland. Not at all, not by a long stretch of the imagination. Because in Northern Ireland, people tend, unlike Karen Bradley, she didn't know that people vote on constitutional basis. So, like, they always vote. Well, not always. It's a big factor when people vote whether they're going to vote on a party that supports the United Ireland or for a party that supports Remain in the United Kingdom. So you'd have the United Irelanders with Sinn Féin, and then you'd have Sten strong in the union with the DUP, as I'm sure you've had the pleasure of speaking to and meeting in Westminster a lot. So
you'd be surprised. They're not really taking that. I mean, you know, you're younger than the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes.
You know, your entire life it's been in force. And there's a possibility that this is going to break it. It's going to return us to a time you personally and your mates and your, you know, brothers and sisters have never known. How do you feel about that?
So with regards never known, we know the impact that it's had. We know the legacy that it's had. We all have parents, we all have grandparents, we know stories. So personally, I do work with cross-community groups, like try and bring children from Protestant and Catholic background, get them playing together, that sort of way, engaging in their cultures and identities, because it's a very emotional issue. But going back to the Troubles, 3,600 people died during the Troubles. It was 30 years of turmoil. Why would we ever want to go back to that? You got Jacob Rees-Mogg saying it's so off the whim. Oh, we just go back to like the border checks back in the Troubles. And then it's just like, well, that's bringing us back to probably one of the most regressive periods in our history. So,
And these are people that are, you know, often sort of talk up patriotism and, oh, you know, the British Army. And, you know, well, you tell, you know, wounded British soldiers, you know, that actually, you know, they got wounded for absolutely nothing because, you know, peace doesn't matter anymore. We've torn it all up and you know, Good Friday Agreement can go to hell. So they're not even on message for their own tribe, let alone thinking about, you know, the greater good of humanity like us normal people.
Well, I would also point to the fact that when you come to the Good Friday Agreement, like as I said earlier, you got to remember it's not just a legal issue; it's a very emotional issue. So even though legalities would have all just people on the border, but like it like then people have lives, they all have families, and that's what's the, like families will be torn apart. There will be chaos. So it's more than just a legal issue, which I really want. That's what we're trying to push in our future, our choice, and
I mean, there are many futures that can come out of this. Obviously, we're hoping we can avert this.
Yeah.
We're all on the same page. But there are many varieties of Brexit that can go through.
Yeah.
And, you know, we try to look ahead on the show occasionally. You know, what's it going to do to the political culture of Britain if, you know, it goes through as a sort of Chequers style or relatively kind of hard Brexit that we think we're expecting. What do you think it's going to do to the culture, the political culture, and the kind of society in Northern Ireland if, setting aside the potential return of Troubles, if we get back to a situation where the British Isles and Northern Ireland are no longer part of Europe? What's it going to do to your generation's ability to do things with their own lives?
Well, with our generation's ability to do anything with our lives, like you can get any young person in the UK to talk, or any young person in the UK to talk about that. I've got a list. We've screaming from the rooftops. You're taking this away from me, the right to travel, the right to live and work where you want, the right to study and stuff like that. But with regards to political and social implications, Brexit, well, in Northern Ireland, Brexit was just another issue on top of many that divide the two parties. So it's just another one. It wasn't really a defining moment. Like, I think it was in the UK, but I wasn't there. But that's the impression that I get. So with regards, it was just like, oh, so DUP and Sinn Féin disagree on gay marriage rights, abortion laws, and all different sort of stuff. So Brexit was just another one of them. It was just another issue that was torn up into the green and orange politics, as we talk about. So unionists be orange, nationalist green, because that's just the way it always has been. So Brexit itself, although it'll have massive implications for people in Northern Ireland, it's not really politically defining because we've already had this tribal mess forever. So
yeah, What do you think?
You mentioned that obviously, like, the DUP is not representative of everyone, yeah. maybe not young people in Northern Ireland. But then you just were touching upon this. Do you think you'd see a return to a movement in Northern Ireland where you want to reunify with Ireland long term down the road?
This conversation, we've spoke to quite a few people, and it was Maria McGuinness, who's Vice President of the European Union at the minute. She's an Irish representative, an MEP, and she says, when we brought this issue up to her, she was like, we should never mix the two conversations, the whole uniting Ireland, the whole unification aspect of, like, that could be added from Brexit, shouldn't be brought into it, because it's a different issue, it's a different matter, that has its own history. But we have run independent polls, and when we ask these independent polls, when Poland and Northern Ireland, you have to be very, because everyone's very political, so you have to be a bigger sample size, geopolitical balance, and get it, people from different political weight and stuff like that. And the findings were that if Brexit goes ahead, never mind a hard Brexit or soft Brexit, if Brexit goes ahead, 52% majority would be for uniting Ireland, mm-hmm. and 39% outright opposed. So, although we should be
by age as well?
Yeah, we caught it by age.
A difference between younger people and older voters?
Unlike the rest of the UK, Northern Ireland wasn't very... it was slightly, with regards to age, you're more likely to vote for Leave. Mm-hmm. But it was more, again, on the two green and orange issues, so it was more aligned to Unionist Loyalists voting for Leave, mm-hmm. and Nationalist Republicans voting to Remain.
Just finally, you've been meeting a lot of MPs.
Yeah.
who's impressed you? Who do you think gets it?
Everyone's been very receptive. I'll tell you the one who I'd find least gets it, because they're all very
brilliant. That's what we really wanted to
do. The dirt.
So it was a very informal impromptu meeting, and we bumped into Hillary Benn, chairing the select committee for leaving the EU, and briefly spoke to him about people's vote and the implications of people's vote, but very much toeing the party line when it comes to Labour. So. Talking all of this, we can stay in the economic area, or we want the general election, and he says it'd be undemocratic for us to have another election. Mm. And then he'd be like, just increase the democracy further, have a people's vote. No, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But
I think he probably feels a bit imprisoned by the...
don't get me wrong, Hillary Benn was fantastic. He is fantastic. He's very good when he's speaking, and he knows the ins and outs of it like no one else. But with regards to us championing our calls for a people's vote, he's just like, the perception is what's going to get people, so people perceiving it as just like, oh, you've lost, you want another go. That's the issue. So,
listen up, Hillary Benn. Listen to the voice of youth. Piers, thanks very much for coming in.
No worries.
Cheers, man.
Thank you.
That was Piers Smith of Oh Fuck Northern Ireland, which we're going to stop saying. It's the People's Vote March on Saturday. Did we mention this? It's the People's Vote March. We're going to see you there. If we do succeed in pulling off a people's vote, if it does happen, then that's far from the end of the story. We would then have to go on ahead and win the thing. But what does winning mean? That's assuming that an option to remain in the EU will be on the ballot at all. So we thought we would take a bit of time to look ahead and war game two potential people's vote campaigns. One where it's a choice simply between deal or no deal. We're going to call that the Noel Edmonds nightmare option, or one where it's a three-way choice between deal, no deal, or remain. Before we get into that, let's do a quick round. What's your top line if you were in charge? Nomi, you are in charge, so you get to go last. Nina, what are your key priorities? What, I mean, you have your issues about whether this is the way to solve it, don't you?
Well, I think my issues are primarily around whether or not this is politically salient, because this has been such a divisive issue that if, you know, the referendum were somehow seen to be co-opted or stolen or turned over, I just don't see how, for the next generation, you kind of detoxify the debate around the referendum. And we're already going to be stuck in Brexit negotiations for like the next 10 years. So do we actually want this to play out in our political and civil life as well? So my top priority, if there was to be a people's vote and Brexit were to be overturned, is to acknowledge that there has to be some kind of psychological bloodletting, right?
Oh, that sounds lovely.
So it has to be, I mean, the people, because what you see is people hardening on both sides of the debate, and ideologues on whatever side of the political debate you are, you know, are just as bad as one another. So you have to kind of, I think, just like the Brexit campaign was very, very good at doing, you know, making Brexit all about the woes of society, right, which actually had nothing to do with the EU. Have to somehow reach out to those people who feel so aggrieved that somehow Brexit has become the silver bullet to all of their problems and they're so angry. You have to reach out to those people. And you have to make sure that if there's a people's vote, that those people don't feel left behind.
Mm-hmm. Ian, suddenly you're in charge of tactics and strategy. What will be your approach to this?
I'm not very good at this stuff. I don't.
That doesn't matter. Neither is anybody else.
No, I just, because whenever they get journalists in and they're like, oh, now how would you do a convention? You know, like occasionally before like a convention speech by like the party leader or whatever, a columnist will do a piece going, and this is what they should say. And I just always think that's really embarrassing because I'm always just like, no, man, you're a fucking hack. Now act like it. You're not like go into some kind of competition to become a politician. And I'm shit at it. Like, I don't really like people and I don't have any particular empathy for them and I don't really like to put myself in their head, so it's very hard for me to imagine what it is that they want to hear. Yeah. Instinctively, the only thing I think is just that you only win if you can, with a straight face, steal their slogan of take back control. Mm. And that if that, whether it's through the exact slogan or through the general messaging, that seems to me to be the point where that would be a winnable campaign, but that is based on nothing but my own prejudice.
So your slogan is take back control.
Exactly.
The Russian dolls. Right. Yeah.
Take back control. Wait, squared.
No, but you are actually planning it. So I mean, yeah. What, you know, can you let light in on the magic of what?
Okay, so so many different parts of it are important. Mm. So first of all, who? Mm. Right, it cannot be the people that lost it for us last time. It cannot be same old tired voices that are part of the reason why we got to leave vote in the first place, because they've allowed, as Nina said, those people to feel left behind and to kick back at the EU when actually it was failed successive governments that have caused their woes and forced, you know, their beliefs around a leave vote. So the who is incredibly important, and we've got to have a much kinder version of everything. We had some brilliant people on from Remainer Now a few weeks ago who talked very importantly about that, and I think one of the only politicians that credibly does that is Caroline Lucas, and I think she speaks very, very well on that issue. So I think we need more of her and probably less of anyone involved in any kind of coalition era, new Labour era. I mean, yes, they can have, you know, they can be involved in the background, but I think as figureheads, it's incredibly important that we don't tarnish ourselves with any of that. And then, you know, in terms of actually doing it, we've got a lot to learn from how Ireland ran their referendum on reforming abortion. It's around having proper citizens' assemblies and town hall meetings and going to people, never expect them to come to us. You know, the sorts of people that we need to talk to don't watch Newsnight and listen to the Today programme and the 10 o'clock news. They're watching The One Show, they're maybe watching Victoria Derbyshire. They're reading the local supermarket shopper and they're on social media. So, you know, the channels are important. The messenger is incredibly important. And as Ian said, the message around, you know, this, if you want to have control over your own lives again and you want Brexit to stop, actually the only way for us to never ever have to talk about any of this again is to get a Remain vote and actually stay in and crack on with the rest of our lives.
Can I do a gentle question on the voices thing, which I get. Like, I get that, like, the image of Tony Blair, the image of Nick Clegg, these are for a lot of people really toxic things. What affected me during the first campaign was that when Leave split in two, every political journalist went, oh, they're fucked, because all of our historical memory is that a disunited party fails to win elections. You know, that's the thing that was always said. But in actual fact, it played quite well for them, because do you remember the way the Remain camp used to think that Nigel Farage was toxic, and they used to talk about him a lot? If you want the country run by Nigel Farage, which, by the way, turned out to be one of their not Project Fear warnings, because that's essentially what happened.
Yeah.
If you want the country run by Nigel Farage, then vote Leave. If you don't, if you want it run by adults, then support us. But actually, so it seemed, and that was true. I mean, people didn't like Nigel Farage. But there was a message for them with Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. This is a serious grown-up thing. You know, we're not lunatics. A lie, but whatever, it worked. And then there was a message to the sort of nativist, really anti-immigration lot. And it didn't feel like they alienated one another. Yeah. It felt like by letting 1,000 flowers bloom, you had it. And
Flowers.
Yes, okay. And flowers is a generous description. But letting 1,000 turds blossom in the sky. Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't... I don't know why. I think all of the stuff that you were saying about new voices, fresh voices, and especially sort of people who've flipped back. But then also to have that backed up by more mainstream voices that people are more used to might seem like it might work as well.
Okay, so it is all about audiences and, you know, the right messenger to deliver the right message and all the rest of it. But what we know is that, as Nina said earlier, the electorate is hardening. And so that pool of persuadables, they are not persuaded by politicians, full stop. Very, very few. And very few celebrities work with them either. It's about local voices. Well, and that's what really resonates with them.
Let's move on to that. One of those models, a three-way vote with Remain on the ballot. So it's no deal, accept the deal, or Remain entirely, which I'm guessing is the one that we'd prefer, because at least it's got Remain on the ballot. Under that circumstance, you've got actually five groups. You've got accept the deal, no deal, and Remain. You've also got didn't vote last time and don't know. And only and one of those groups is in the bag, that's Remain, and three of them are up for grabs. So isn't that quite an optimistic way to look at things? Yeah, out of five groups, you've got one and three are available.
Well, especially because, I mean, the ones that didn't vote last time were often because they were quite young and they're overwhelmingly Remain. And the don't knows from the polling that I've seen recently break towards Remain very, very strongly indeed. Hmm. So the expectations would be pretty positive, I think.
And also in the accept the dealers on their second preference go for Remain as well. So if you had three choices on a ballot paper, you would almost certainly have a preferential voting system, and it splits the Leave vote. So that was the Justine Greening proposal a few months ago, and YouGov polled it really, really quickly, and basically Remain won because it split the Leave vote.
The trouble, of course, with all of these, by the way, is what does no deal mean on a ballot paper? Because if it means you're making it illegal to pass any deal with the EU, you've just given up your ability to fly there, because you need an aviation treaty.
I bet you there are quite a few people who would actually vote for that scenario.
Yeah, you can't even fucking
now.
Fly.
Yeah, exactly. out.
Yeah, brick up the tunnel. No, I obviously massive assumptions here, but I think it's unlikely that it would be legally binding that you can't make any deal. It would be, we will leave the EU on the 29th of March with no further, you know, kind of contractual or treaty obligation.
But purely from a campaigning perspective, that is very, very troubling, because in normal parlance, no deal means you stick with what you've got, right? If you go to a car dealership with your old banger and you want to get a trade-in and you don't like the price, you drive away in your old banger, you don't leave your car there and walk home. Mm. Yeah. So it is just tricky to put no deal on a ballot paper, because a lot of people will assume that means staying in.
Yeah. I guess you could put no trade deal. And I mean, the Electoral Commission would have to batter the shit out of that.
Yeah.
Legally, they have to go through a whole process of battering it around before it can go on the ballot paper. And I'm guessing it would need further specificity than that, or else it would be a quite, frankly, insane thing to put on a ballot paper. Although the fact that it's insane shouldn't stop it from happening.
I know. Well, I mean, a thousand insane things happen every week, as we talk about regularly on the podcast. Before we get into the nightmare scenario of just straight up Noel Edmonds deal or no deal, in a campaign for a three-way ballot, how do we, on the kind of pro-EU side, combat that argument that will arise that we already voted on this and we made our decision? How do we then get across to people that not only that they need to vote again, but they need to vote differently?
You know, the argument that has clearly been focus grouped into oblivion, which is to say, well, now it's on the terms. And Naomi, you've made this point a million times, which I think all of us said. And I think that Alex the other day called it an intellectually sort of undefeatable argument. I think it is. Like, I think it's morally and intellectually watertight, which is to say, right, that was based on this proposition, which bears almost no resemblance whatsoever to the stuff that's being discussed right now. It wasn't like, would you like to have two Irish backstops? No one put that on the side of a bus. So now it would be, this is actually what it looks like. And to be honest, it is becoming clearer and clearer what it will actually look like under May's terms. When she's the Chequers thing, which is obviously quite vague and impossible, nevertheless actually gives you a fairly good idea as to what things, at least considerably more clarity than before, and enough of a moral reason to go, okay, well, now you need to sign up to this specific plan rather than just the full unicorn that you got before.
Well, FYI, Chequers is also totally unworkable. Which we've already talked about.
But the answer to people who say it's under democratic isn't less democracy.
Yeah.
At Best of Britain, we have tested to destruction what works. And you know what? Final say resonates so much better than people's vote. And that's why we use final say, final say, final say, final say, because it has finality. People are effing bored of Brexit. We think we are because we have to do it day in, day out. But the public are tired of it. So they like the finality of that. And they like the fact that it's getting their say.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't be up to the politicians. It should be up to the people. And that's what works.
Mm. Now, what happens if this if the ballot is a two-way ballot? It's deal or no deal. It's accept whatever cobbled together sort of cut and shunt thing Theresa May has managed to get through Parliament. Or it's we leave on whatever remains of WTO rules. What do we as Remainers do? Do we stay at home?
No, I mean, look, I'm not going to be funny about this. It will fucking hurt. But you get out there and you campaign for a deal. I mean, it is the horror scenario. But let's be clear on just a basic patriotic level. You do not allow no deal to happen to this country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like there is no exaggeration about the extent of what that involves and what it involves people on low incomes, on struggling middle incomes, mm-hmm. what it does to the status of the country, what it would do to internal relations in this country. And if people think that it can't get any worse than this, it can get yes. worse than this. Okay, mm-hmm. so even in that scenario, and I'm not pretending that, you know, I wouldn't feel sick to my guts to do it, mm-hmm. you get out there and you campaign for a deal.
Yeah, and I suppose it depends on what the deal is. I mean, if the deal is, you know, what would be described in the Telegraph as a complete capitulation and a total betrayal of et cetera, fill in the blank, it might hurt a little bit less to campaign for it because if we're down to, you know, do you remember Brexit in name only years ago?
Mm. You know, I remember it very well because there's a good chance it will still happen.
Yeah, mm. yeah. It wouldn't hurt that much to campaign for that, would it?
I think there's a pretty good chance, by the way, that, so there's the two ways of looking at what would happen with May's stuff. I mean, one of them is that it would all just completely collapse after a few years and we'd be out. It's possible that there's enough hooks there, especially if the legal part that relates to the divorce treaty is linked to the future relationship part. And it includes that we sign up to regulations on process as well as outcome, as well as customs. You then have a pretty good jumping off pad to go for, okay, fine, well, we'll include services as well, which the EU will make the condition exactly. of it, and we can expect the British government to capitulate to. And in that scenario, look, there's no certainty, it's uncertain, it's not where you'd want to be, it's nothing that you'd want to support or push for, but there would be a pretty damn good chance that you would end up in a very, very soft Brexit in about 10 years' time.
Okay, well, this is obviously, we've only touched the surface of it on this. I think we're going to be returning to that particular issue of how we would run a People's Vote campaign or how it should be run in weeks to come. But that is the end of the show, which means it's time for the Brexit time capsule. Nina, you've been away for a while. Would you like to put inside our stasis chamber of things we'll miss if we leave the EU?
I'm really going to miss a few standout Twitter accounts. I'm talking about the Irish border. You know, who are amazing. You? I love you. You're wonderful.
Brilliant, yes.
And I also like the Twitter account that's just called Has Turkey Joined Yet? And it just goes, no.
Leave so, means lies no. is quite good too.
I think they may well keep trundling along those guys. You know, it's entirely possible. But we'll put them in. And now it's time for a bit of a non-English EU language to see us off. Here's a bit of German from Martin Terrian.
The Obelix sagte, die spinnen die Briten.
That means, as Obelix said, these Britons are crazy. There's a British character. Yeah! There's a British character in Asterix called Anticlimax, which is
brilliant.
Very Brexit, I think you'll agree. So send us your closing clip in any European language of your choice, except English, obviously. Just record something on your phone, keep it clean-ish, and email it with a translation to info@romaniacs.com, and we will use the best ones. And that's the end of the show. Thanks to Nina, Naomi, and Ian. Who's coming on the march then? I'm coming on the march. You are, Naomi.
Totally. And just really, really last quick thing. We're going to do a massive training session straight after the march for anyone who wants to go back to their constituency and prepare for war. So just email info@vesselwritten.org to find out more about that.
Nina and Dunt, will you be there or are you going to be staying out of the throng?
I might.
You might, okay. come along and I'll buy you both a pint.
Oh, I'll be there.
Oh, there we are. Yeah, easily done. So we'll see you all there on Saturday. We're going to be meeting outside the Dorchester on Park Lane from about 11:30 noonish or something. The entire listenership's going to come.
All radical movements have met outside of the Dorchester.
Absolutely, yeah. Good enough.
From the levellers onwards.
Absolutely. Good enough for Karl Marx, good enough for me. Listeners, don't forget, you can get your episode of Romaniacs a day early if you support us on Patreon, plus desirable T-shirts, mugs, and a weekly column by one of our panellists. Just search Patreon Romaniacs to find out more. We're going to see you next time, or on Saturday. Now here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a salute to our latest Patreon backers.
Hello and thanks from me to Chris Elston, Richard Sunley, Mark Bailey, Will, that's just Will, and Ivan Moran.
Thanks from me to Joe Gilbert, Steve Ashford, Scott, Keith Brown and Tim Lynch.
And hello from me to Chris Murphy, Cormac Flynn, Sergio Garcia, Mark Percival and Tony Howarth.
And it is a major high five from me to Nicholas Barnes, Marcus Pfeiffer, Jenny Smith, Declan Kelly and Kit Allwinter. Many thanks, we're going to see you all next week.
Romaniacs was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison with Naomi Smith, Ian Dunt and me, Nina Shake. Audio production was by Sophie Black. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.